3 after a brief summer recording break. We clear up, clear out the backlog?
Yeah, I wish I could say I cleared out the backlog, yeah, but we're still 2 episodes behind. But
we're working on it.
We should be up to date by September because I can only upload so much a month. So
right. And there on the other end, discussing the technical side, is Tim Slagle. I'm Brian Miller.
Hey.
And it's been, if we were going to take a couple of weeks to worry about the backlog, we really couldn't have picked a better couple of weeks.
No,
it's
nothing.
The slowest news time that there is.
No, everybody goes on vacation.
Yeah, and then Minnesota got the state fair starting up, which is, for people who live outside of Minnesota, I think somewhat impossible for them to comprehend why that would affect anything. But like, everybody goes to the fair.
Minnesota State Fair is like Minnesota's Mardi Gras.
That's really interesting. I've never heard anybody put it like that, and that is exactly what it is. Because, kind of the way you figure Mardi Gras basically shuts down New Orleans for a few days. This one shuts down Minnesota for a week.
Yeah, but it isn't. It isn't about beads. It's about butter carvings
and seed art. And I've been saying on stage this week, the state fair is great because it's the only place where you can watch a cow prolapse while you eat a pair of deep fried Zubas on a stick. But while we were away, the big news story, and I think this is quite indicative of how slow the news cycle is right now, is that San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick is refusing to stand for the national anthem, and he's sitting through it out of a protest, shorthand you could say, essentially for the kind of Black Lives Matter anti-police brutality message, sort of his stance. Now, you're not a football guy, right?
Not at all.
So you'd never heard of Colin Kaepernick.
I had never even heard of Colin Kaepernick until this happened.
And what's interesting is if you're a casual fan, you were on the cusp of knowing who Colin Kaepernick was. And if you're a serious fan, you're very aware of who he is because he is a young quarterback who, in his first couple of seasons with the San Francisco 49ers, looked like he was going to be the hot new thing. I mean, he was unbeatable. He was so good. He plays a different style of football in what they call the pistol offense, which allows him to both run around and then improvise and throw it. And he's very athletic and he's very fast. And took the Niners to the Super Bowl, almost won it, didn't quite. And then his coach left. And then the next year, the team fell apart and he fell apart. And he's been the worst quarterback in the league for the last couple of years.
You know what it reminds me of from my childhood? There was a character in baseball, Mark the Bird Fidrich.
And I'm not familiar.
Yeah, he was Detroit Tigers, and he was a weirdo on the mound. He would talk to the ball, and he had like all these quirky behaviors in that, and he was people were nuts over him. His games were selling out. Even then they had a hard time filling the ballparks. His games were all selling out, and he looked at it as the same thing. It looked like he was going to be, one of the best pitchers of all time. And the second season, he never did it. And he was kept on the roster for years afterwards, even though, his star had long faded because they thought that, he was a star at one point. So it sounds very similar to me.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing in athletics where, I mean, Colin might have gotten an injury here or there, but I don't think it was that, he got a major injury and he can't run as fast anymore. His arm isn't as strong. It was a temporary fleeting thing. I think.
Is it possible, and I don't pay any attention to football, but is it possible that the first season, his erratic behavior confused the other teams? But
yeah, like
a year later, they caught on to it.
I think that's the thing. Remember the baseball player Hideo Nomo, one of the first big Japanese pitchers to come out when they first started bringing. That's kind of common now. And Nomo came out, and I forget who he played for, but he had this really bizarre windup. It was this really odd, exaggerated, like almost face away from the player in turn, and he was unhittable for a year. But it was athletes are smart guys in a lot of ways, and then certainly physically they're basically, you know, an athlete is essentially a physical genius.
Right.
And so they adapt, and they learn, and pretty soon you go, oh, that's how he's doing it. Oh, I'll just, okay.
Yeah, that's what that sounds like to me. That sounds like that's what happened, is that they figured out his stunt.
And yep, so, and he did not continue to evolve.
So what do you do when you when everyone figures out your stunt and you're not first string anymore? You come up with a new one.
So you think this is a PR stunt?
Oh, absolutely.
See, I think it's the opposite. He's going to get fired over this. Like, he's going to get fired because he was already going to be cut almost for sure. He was already third on the depth chart coming into the last game of the preseason, and he hasn't been getting a lot of reps, which is a strong indicator that they're going to cut him. But I think they were going to cut him for football reasons before, and this gives them further not only a little bit of an excuse, but also it just helps make their decision because it's like you got a guy who's not playing well, and you're getting weird press over him. You know, no stadium wants even mixed press, even if half the stadium loves him.
I disagree. I think it's the exact opposite. I think that this is his attempt to stay on the to stay employed. I think he knows he's about to get cut, but now that he's done this, if he gets cut, he can scream that it's racism. Even though he was raised whiter than I was.
Yeah, I believe he does have adopted. I think his stepfather's white.
It's the exact opposite. His real father's white. His mother is white.
Yes.
And he was adopted by a white family, and he was raised in a town in California that's 1% African American, and it would be 2% African American.
But
both his parents were black.
But do you think that inherently validates his opinion about a political topic?
I don't think it invalidates his opinion, but I think it's the reason behind his opinion. My guess is that the other guys on the team have been calling him white.
Well, you see, on the other hand, he's gotten more static than almost anybody for, like, being a tattooed black guy. He got all kinds of criticism for having the big sleeve tattoos, and he got the word thug tossed at him a lot. So in another context, he's certainly been treated like a black athlete.
Huh. It's. I wouldn't even. If you showed me his picture, I wouldn't even have guessed he was black.
Oh, I would have thought he was like. I mean, I would have said like, oh, he's like The Rock. He's like an interesting blend of stuff. You know, if you'd have told me, hey, he's part Polynesian.
Nah, he looks Middle Eastern to me. Put him in front of a cab. Put him in the front seat of a cab, and I would have never guessed he was black.
Well, put him in the front seat of the cab, and apparently 2 years later, somebody better's driving the cab. I mean, that's his fundamental problem. I do think it's weird also that people critique his personal, his like athletic performance. Like, he's not even good at football. What is like, so if Cam Newton did it, do you think people would be less mad?
I don't know. I think the reason, you know, it's like I said, it seems that what he's trying to do is he's trying to get press. He's trying to get into the top of the sports headlines again.
Well, I mean, you're assuming motive here. I mean, that's something that we can't really know unless he says it or there's some evidence that's put out to the thing. I think he will get fired in the next couple of weeks or let go. He'll get cut, and it won't be. But here's my hot take on it. Well, first off, it's a symbol. I'm not a big fan of symbolism. I don't care. I don't think you should ever be more than like a 3 out of 10 level angry about a symbol, or happy, by the way. When you win a symbolic victory, it's still symbolic. Nobody won anything, you know? But my thing is, if you're going to be mad at Colin Kaepernick for not standing during the national anthem, you got to still also be mad at everybody in the concession stand for continuing to sell food and beer. I mean, are we all stopping to observe a very important ritual, or is everybody else in the entire stadium going about their business except for like 50 guys?
Now, have you ever actually gone out for a hot dog and a beer during the national anthem and actually seen people in line and people serving?
They don't stop serving food and beer. It's business as usual out there. I mean, a lot of people in the stadium
don't even
serve.
You can actually verify that. You can actually verify that there is food being served down in the. So I guess it's
sometimes
just when
people in line will put their hands over their hearts or whatever. Every now and then you'll see somebody take their ball cap off. But you know, there's so much chatter out there. It's so loud usually outside in that section. You kind of hear it, but you basically don't.
Yeah, nope, never been there, so I didn't know.
I've never seen concession stops being sold at a baseball game either during the national anthem or a hockey game.
And here's my take on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you want to make a stand, go ahead and make a stand. But when you're wearing the uniform of your employer, you're at work.
No, and that's fair.
When you're wearing the Applebee's costume and the happy birthday song starts playing over on the other side of the restaurant, you're expected to go and gather around the table.
That's funny. I certainly can see that point, even though I am not mad at Kaepernick. But what I am is aware that we are just a little bit over time. Back in the next segment. Now, the second segment of Rule of Three here, a little bit of sad comedy news. Gene Wilder died at the age of 83.
What's sad to me, honestly, and I hate to say this, and this happens often with celebrities that have been out of the public eye for a while, I didn't know that he was alive.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a very... understandable reaction to particularly Gene Wilder, who after his wife Gilda Radner died, pretty much stopped acting.
Yeah.
He did a TV sitcom in 1994 that ran for 15 episodes that I remember actually really enjoying and my brother and I really liking. Just a really funny scene that I still remember quite well.
Well, go ahead.
Well, you know, the setup was basically he had an annoying house guest. It was like his wife's friend or something. And he would, he would finally tell her what he thinks. And then it would kind of cut back 20 seconds. And you'd realize, oh, that was what he was, all the mean things he was thinking. And you'd see him being all polite. And they set that up twice. Whereas I did not know about the rule of three as a kid. So I was not expecting that the third time they run it, he says all the mean things. And then there's the pause. And they're still standing there. And he says, oh, no, I said that out loud. And the whole episode is about accidentally saying what you're really thinking. And my brother and I thought that was the funniest thing in the world. We were just dying over that.
Could that have been the birth of that meme? Because that's like a standard joke right now. Is oops, did I just say that out loud?
Yeah, I mean that was certainly at the very least he was. If it didn't inspire it, he beat it to the punch by a solid decade and a half.
Yeah, at least
because it was very, very funny. So after that series didn't go, it looks like he basically did a little bit of voice work in TV movies. He did a brief appearance on Will and Grace in 2002. He did two episodes of that. And he did a voice in a Nickelodeon thing in 2015. So, I mean, Basically nothing after 94.
But and really apparently nothing after... he had Alzheimer's, so apparently
yes,
he,
there was
also,
that too.
He was also, he also removed himself from the public eye, most likely because of that.
I certainly don't, I certainly can't fault anybody for that. And that's always the... You know, it's so sad. Gene Wilder, taken too soon. I'm like, well, maybe he was ready.
Taken too soon, but yet I didn't know he had a sitcom in the 90s. You know?
Yeah, it was a big deal. I remember, it was one of those things that, like, at the time, you probably were aware of it because they advertised it like crazy.
Yeah, but I don't remember it. I don't think I ever watched a single episode
gone,
of it.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you the situation the comedy took place in.
Exactly. It was like there's certain TV shows that you're like, they're, you know, like the Michael J. Fox show when he was going to come back on NBC. I mean, you could not escape the advertising for that. And now I think people have already forgotten that happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's an old, and I might have actually mentioned this in the podcast before, but it was somebody actually wrote an editorial after Lucille Ball died, and everyone was saying, "Oh, we all loved Lucy." It's like, really? You know, the last three series that she was in, nobody really cared for. And, in fact, they were vicious with her about how bad those last three situation comedies were. It's we don't love Lucy. We loved Lucy.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. But now people still do really love Gene Wilder. And I think, he was always iconic for two particular roles, I would say. Willy Wonka, of course, big for kids, and then you get a little older and Young Frankenstein.
Willy Wonka, it's actually, I've learned to like, I did not like that movie when it came out.
Me neither. I did not like that as a kid at all.
And now looking back on it, I look at it more fondly than I actually did when it came out.
I like how, what I really like about it as a movie, other than that's a kind of interesting message, but I really like his performance specifically. I love how pretty unhinged and just this side of terrifying it is.
Right, which maybe is why, you know, which maybe is why as a kid it's like, you know, this isn't fun. This isn't funny. Why would you want to go to that factory? That place is horrid. You know what I mean? Is that it might be more from an adult perspective that we think that kids would like it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there because it's such an experience of childhood, you know, to look forward to something and to construct something as the greatest thing in the world and then get there. And then, of course, you know, be more let down than you ever could be as an adult, you know, when you can no longer be that excited about something. And so the movie always was kind of a tease in that way to me, too, is that, like, theoretically, you're in the movie wanting to go to this factory with this kid, and then you go, and it sucks. And so it was just such a bummer of a movie. I never liked the movie.
But have you read the book?
I have not read the book either. I was not a big Roald Dahl reader as a kid for whatever reason.
It's kind of interesting. Is the Oompa Loompas did not look like Donald Trump in the book.
Oh, yeah, they do, don't they?
They actually kind of looked more like Obama.
Really?
Uh-huh. They were like pygmies.
Oh, interesting. That's why they're like little. They're supposed to be like Australian, Australian bush.
And they're essentially, Willy Wonka went to Africa and took them all, found out that they would work for cocoa beans.
Wow.
So
I can see why they edited that out.
He took the Oompa Loompas which if you think about it, when all of a sudden the term becomes extremely racist.
It's funny you say that. I was like, wow, that sounds like something a really hateful guy in Alabama would yell out of a car. These Oompa Loompas are taking our jobs, you know? And you're like, yeah, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
It's like there was a football slight sidetrack. There was a football player who got hit in the head while he was on the sideline, while he wasn't wearing his helmet, and he got a concussion. And it turned out the punter had just wildly miskicked it. And they kept saying the phrase, errant punt. And I said to my buddy, errant punt sounds like something an angry British guy calls you. It just sounds dirty. You errant punt. And you're like, whoa, hey, calm down there, Prince Charles. But I was not a huge fan of that. And the funny thing is, I really like Gene Wilder a lot, but I was not. I like Young Frankenstein, but I do not personally find Young Frankenstein to be the epitome of comedy that some people do.
I saw it when I was when it was first shown. I actually saw it in the might have been in a drive-in that I saw it.
Ooh, that's
and
cool.
I wasn't swept away with it.
And I think there's things about it that are very funny, and particularly, I mean, Wilder, again, his performance is fantastic. Peter Boyle's performance is great, and Madeline Kahn is very funny. But I personally, I'm just not a big Mel Brooks guy.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Young Frankenstein, and I don't know that I actually got the Frankenstein joke.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
That it's actually kind of a Jewish joke.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, my name isn't Wiener, it's Weiner.
Right.
Is that Jews do that all the time. And I didn't get that level of the joke. For me, it was just, he doesn't want to be called Frankenstein. I get it. But it actually has another level that I never really understood. What's fascinating to me about the movie is that was the actual sets that they did the original Frankenstein on.
I didn't know that. I didn't, and I'm a huge Frankenstein fan.
Universal was going to tear down that corner of the lot because they weren't using it anymore. And when Mel Brooks found out about that, he said, "Can we do one last film on there?" And then actually went out of his way to use the actual cameras and the actual kind of film stock and the actual sets. And in that aspect, that's kind of cool. It was a really nice tribute to an era of movie history.
Yeah, I've always liked the movie's aesthetic a lot. And I just thought they, you know, recreated. I didn't realize they were using the same set. I thought they just did a very nice job of recreating that set.
Actually was. And if you think about it, too, and this is really weird. You know, it's like, wow, that set was still in existence. Well, when they were making those movies, that was like the 50s, the 40s and 50s, and this was the 70s, so it was only 30 years. So it's like, you know, it's like a set that was built in the 80s being finally torn down.
Yeah.
It really wasn't that. It wasn't that as much. There's more distance between young Frankenstein and now than there probably was between when those films were being made and young Frankenstein.
That's absolutely true. Also, you know, back in the day, they needed a lot of castle sets and old science lab. You know, there was a lot of, if you were into horror movies, you'd see a lot of the same stuff. If you were eagle-eyed on those Universal movies, it's like, oh, we got a big castle door. Okay. Someone's going to get a castle door a lot. But so I would also – there's two things that I love Gene Wilder from before we wrap up. He's got a little part in Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, which I – great movie. But my personal favorite is him in Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex, But We're Afraid to Ask.
I didn't realize that was – I had always heard – I've never actually seen the film.
It's really funny.
And I've heard about the sheep scene.
Yes, and he's the guy, I believe he's the one who takes the sheep to the hotel.
Until today, I never realized that was Gene Wilder.
It is so funny and so dirty, that scene. I mean, it's just bestiality humor for 10 minutes. It's so funny, though. I would recommend watching that one. But my Wilder theory, I realize, is, you know, I really like him, but I think he was better overall than he was given credit for, even, because I think like a football player, like Dan Marino, say, on the Dolphins, who was a great quarterback, but who never had a great team around him, I think Wilder was often the best part of the movies he was in, and wasn't given the luxury of being in a movie that was where he was surrounded by a lot of other greatness often. Even though he was in movies with Richard Pryor and all these other actors, I think sometimes the material fell short for him.
And speaking of material falling short,
Time to get. And on the final segment of Rule of Three, just catch up with what we've been up to. I had a pretty fun thing to be up to this last week. Headlined my first week at Acme Comedy Company.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It was great. I realized it was the most excited I've ever been about a week of comedy since my first week at Acme.
Wow. Wow, since your first week emceeing.
Yeah. I mean, that was – which was – you were headlining, if you recall.
Don't recall.
Me – it was a Christmas
– I've worked with you. I've worked with you so many times.
Yeah, sure.
I never – I don't know when the first time that you – you know, I don't –
No, you might remember this, though, when I bring it up. It was because what it was the week between Christmas and New Year's when you've got – or I think – it was either right before Christmas or between Christmas and New Year's where you had some kind of time off. You know, it was an awkward week. So it was right before Christmas, come to think of it. So it was like – I think we only worked like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday or something because of the holidays. And me and Trevor Anderson and Nate Abshire had all three just gotten hired.
Oh.
Remember? And we did that show where you – we did it like Vegas style.
I do remember it now. It was the rather than a middle act, there were three middle acts or something
like
that.
It was like Tim Slagle and friends, basically.
Yeah. No, and, God, I remember that now. Yes.
Yeah, that was my very first week at Acme. And, I mean, I moved to Minneapolis to do comedy and specifically to work at Acme. And it was all that I thought of. I wanted to work other clubs as well, but – I mean, that was the goal, and it was like all that I thought about, and my happiness pretty much hinged on the twists and turns of trying to get hired in at Acme. And then when I finally did, it was just like, that's the great thing about Acme is when they hire you, if you're an in-town guy and you're in the system, it's not like you get 1 week and then you're done. Like, they're committing to kind of give you a lot of weeks to kind of help you get better.
No, they're putting the brand on you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a system, and they want to work you up through the system. So it's like when you work at Acme, when you first start, you're an MC, and you MC pretty much every 6 weeks, and you do Tuesday through Saturday, eight shows, or seven or eight shows with a top-notch headliners. So the experience is like...
Well, sometimes you get me.
Right, sometimes you get me, apparently, too. So it don't always work out for people. But it's almost impossible to overstate how much better people are after their first year of working at Acme. Just getting all that practice in and all that good practice.
Right, right. And the expectation that exists at Acme, too.
The other comics are driving you because you go to the Monday open mic and you're seeing these guys where it's like, man, Andy just had 3 new minutes of one-liners, you know, and then, you know, Cy just wrote a 5-new-minute bit, you know, that's killing already. So it's like, I better write something new or I'm going to look like an idiot.
Right. But more than that, it's the latitude to fail that exists at Acme that doesn't exist anywhere else. That, you know, most clubs they judge from outside the room.
Yes.
You know, and if the room is noisy, the comic is good.
Yeah. No. And absolutely.
No matter
true.
What that comic has to do to make that room noisy, that's what they rate it on. Whereas Acme actually looks at what you're doing. And if you're doing something just to me, you know, if you're putting your hand under your armpit to make fart noises, don't expect another booking.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I first started, I think I must have been looking pretty nervous, and Lewis walked over to me, and the owner, I'd never really talked to him, and he said, if you have a bad set, it's fine. If you have two bad sets, it's fine. If you have three, that's fine, too. He goes, it doesn't matter. It's just as long as they're different bad sets. And I was like, oh, okay. I see what you're having. It really made me feel so much better. And it was such a better attitude to come at it with. I think, you know, one of the other clubs I think that does that with the booking, and it's certainly a different way, but Skyline is a fun club. And one of the things I love about Cliff, the owner of Skyline, is that he definitely judges the show. If you're doing good material that's not working, nobody's more angry about it than Cliff. Like, he hates a bad audience more than I've ever seen a comedian hate a bad audience. I mean, he's just livid. He's like, you were so funny up there, and these idiots, F them. Like, okay, he'll get really mad on your behalf. And it's like, thanks, Cliff. Like, he's a passionate supporter of a good comic. You know?
Well, Cliff has always seemed that he's been upset that he's been stuck in the region of America that he is.
I think he's found his groove.
Yeah, he travels a lot. But what I'm saying is I think he would much rather be in Minneapolis or Chicago or somewhere else where he could actually, you know, book the comics that he enjoys rather than have to please the crowd. He would rather, you know, he would like to be pleasing a better crowd. I think that's what.
Possibly. But I think he's always leaning into bringing in more interesting people. And that's one of the things I like about him. But I just love that, like, most club owners will generally take the side of any crowd over any comic. So to have it be, like, so strongly the other way, where you see, like, the guy, like, yelling at the crowd, you're like, this is great. This guy's on my side. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I did I've done a couple shows, actually, where it's one in particular, I guess I can say this one. Well, actually, both of them are closing now. Both the clubs where incidents like that happened to me are closing now.
Really?
Yeah. Is Wisecrackers, I think it is what it's called now, in Merrillville, Indiana.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And Courtney's in Fargo, North Dakota.
Yep, which is on its kind of last legs.
Which I heard it's for sale, so that it's...
Ah, yeah, I can't imagine. Someone told me that the microphones weren't working for whole shows there, and they were doing unmiked shows.
Yeah, I think it closes every summer, and it's probably not going to open in the fall. But what happened there was, yeah, it was just a group of women. It was a first week of hunting, so it was all the hunting widows.
Oh, sure.
And they weren't entertained by me, so they were ignoring me and just sitting there talking. And well, I chased them out of the room.
Yeah.
And I probably should have just let them go.
Sure.
But I couldn't help but make a snide remark as they were leaving, and that I'm not proud of, so I won't repeat it.
not suitable for air, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm just not going to repeat it.
Did you call them an errant punt?
uh, I made the reference.
Sure.
I did not say that, but yes, there was a very distinct reference, and they all wrote letters to the club.
Oh.
And I could not. I was banned from the room for several years, 5 years at least.
That I was,
management
run.
Had to change twice, I think, before wow. I was allowed back. Yeah, it was so bad, and it was exactly that. It was like you offended the audience. It's like, and the booker at the time was saying, you know, look, here's one of the letters right here. It says this comedian continually interrupted our private conversation.
Wow.
He's like, hello.
Yeah.
Don't you understand? And they're like, nope, they're our audience. It's his job to entertain them. And if he wasn't entertaining them, we don't want him back.
They're basically like a diner if the jukebox yelled at somebody who was doing something wrong. And they're like, well, get that jukebox out of here and get a new jukebox in here. We're trying to sell burgers. I mean, that's the attitude that a lot of people have. And that's one of the things that makes Acme great is it's never the attitude that they have. And
No, I've chased people out of Acme all the time.
Well, I believe you hold the record for the most people chased out of Acme.
Yeah, 90% of the room.
and a crowd. Not 90% of 20 people either, right?
Like, no, 270. So, yeah, it went from 270 to 27.
What was it you said to make that happen? I don't think I've ever actually heard why that happened.
Well, there's actually a couple incidents, and I only bring up one. Is that it was the week that that Paul Wellstone died. The week after Paul Wellstone died.
People were feeling pretty sensitive.
Well, it wasn't actually after he died. It was the week after the memorial, I think.
Oh, sure.
I think it was the week after the memorial. And I said, well, actually, it was election week. And I had done a bit. I had come in and I had done a theater show for Acme the week before.
Mm-hmm.
And the line I did was when they nominated Mondale, I said what I think everybody said is, isn't he dead too?
That's funny. That's not that bad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was funny on Sunday. It was funny on Monday. Tuesday was election day. It was not funny that night.
Huh.
Because it was apparent to all the Mondale supporters who were in the room that that Mondale was not that they had lost the Senate. So
I always remember there's a great Dennis Miller line from back then about Walter Mondale made McGovern look like William the Conqueror.
And on that note,
yes.
I think we're done. TimSlegel.com, all the episodes. Also on iTunes. You can hear them on iTunes.
And Real Brian Miller, BrianMillerComedy.com. And hopefully we didn't walk 90% of the audience this week. I don't think we did. I think we kept everybody around.
All 27.
All 27. All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.